Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
Hi, this is Jay Bradshaw with LRM, helping out.
And this is a Spotlight Friday episode. And today we're going to be talking about three DC books, actually. Not so recent, but we're getting caught up on a lot of reading here. So we're going to talk about Justice League number 19. We're going to talk about Shazam number 3. I'm going to talk about the ever controversial Heroes in Crisis series when we talk about issue number 6. And that's, I think, actually where I want to start. So let me give the creative team really quickly. As many people know, it is written by Tom King. The art in this particular issue, rather than being handled by the regular series artist, the majority of it is handled by Mitch Gerrits. We do have Clay Mann, who handles the art in most of the series, doing the first page and the last page. And then we have Tameu Morey on colors for Clay Mann's work. Mitch Gerrits colors his own work. And then regular letterer Clayton Cowles. So this is an interesting issue of Heroes in Crisis. Most of what we've seen of the story so far, if you remember back when we covered issue 1, it sort of starts off after the big event has happened, right? Like after all the heroes have been killed at Sanctuary and the cat's sort of out of the bag, and the other narrative storylines we've had are dealing with the fallout of that. Obviously, Lois has been receiving messages from somebody about the existence of Sanctuary. It's not a secret anymore. In issue 5, Superman gave a big speech, basically trying to reassure the public that just because the heroes had this sanctuary place where they went to kind of recharge and deal with the PTSD and the constant exposure to violence and evil, depravity, whatever you want to call it, that might affect them mentally. That despite all that, it wasn't a reason to think that their heroes were broken. In fact, it was a reason to celebrate that their heroes in a lot of ways were just like them, and they needed a place to go, a sanctuary, if you will. So that's been a lot of what the series has been so far, along with a little bit of investigation on what's happened. Like how did all these people die? Who's responsible for it? What happened? You know, Batman and Flash have been sort of investigating. Batman doing his detective thing, and Barry Allen, the Flash, doing forensic investigation, trying to figure out how this happened. This issue 6, is the first time where the vast majority of the issue takes place. In fact, I want to say nearly all of the issue, it takes place before the events of issue 1. None of the issue 6 occurs after. This is all before. I suppose in a way, if you wanted to, you could even read this before issue 1. But it's interesting the things that that Tom King is saying here. And I think this is the reason that a lot of people, or at least some people, don't get this series, or they say they don't like it. It's a very cerebral series. You really have to stop and think about the things that Tom King is saying. This isn't, you know, some sort of, you know, just popcorn movie, you know, where it's just eye candy. You read it and it's a bunch of heroes fighting each other. They're really sort of fighting themselves and fighting their nature and fighting human nature in a way, and dealing with loss and the flaws that are inherent in us, whether we're a superhero or a regular citizen. And I think that part of it goes over a lot of people's heads, or they just find it to be boring. That's not what they want out of their superhero comics, which is totally valid. You know, I'm not going to tell somebody that you have to read this and you have to like it, but if it's not for you, that's fine. It doesn't mean that it's bad. So the issue starts off and we get one of the confessionals, and the title of the issue has to do with people being saved. Like, how many people have you saved is the question that they're asking everybody in the confessional. And sort of a theme that runs throughout the issue, you know, what does that mean to be saved? Who is saved? And so we see three characters on the first page. We see Narc, who's sort of this caveman who's, I'm not that familiar with him, to be honest. And I didn't I meant always meant to go back and look stuff up about him, but I never did. But I think he has some sort of immortality. He's lived for like a really long time, but he like technically is a caveman. And he, the big, a big part portion of this issue is focused on him, really all three of the characters that are here on the first page. So, you know, Narc's being asked that question, how many people have you saved? Wally West, the Flash, is being asked that question, and Harley Quinn is being asked that question again. And none of them are just straight up like, okay, this is how many people I saved. Narc's like, I don't even really know what you mean. Like, who is saved? I don't know. In his broken language that he speaks, Narc not know. And Wally West is like, you know, what matters is the people that you didn't reach. That's what matters. You got to, you know, not the number of people. That's bragging. And Harley's like, how many people have you saved? You know, it's very antagonistic about it. It's like, why do I have to save anybody? It's very closed off. And I will say that the art on this first page by Clay Mann, you know, Clay Mann's an incredible artist. He does a great job of conveying the body language of Harley being closed off with her arms crossed and rolling her eyes and stuff. And then as we get into the main part of the issue here, second page, we shift over to the Mitch Garrett's art, and we do see Narc there. And it's clear that he's in one of those, I don't know, for lack of a better term, call him like the holodecks within Sanctuary. And he's talking about the old world, like before he was frozen, before he woke up and became a superhero in the new world. So kind of did that whole Captain America thing. And he's reminiscing. He misses that world. And it's kind of a theme that plays throughout the narrative that we have. Because a lot of people go like, Narc, man, I don't have any idea who that guy is. Why is Tom King telling a story about him? But he has something pretty important to say about Narc, and we'll get to that. But it's a great page. It's a full page splash. And Narc's thinking, yeah, the sky is pretty, the stars, this is what the world was like before Narc was frozen. And it makes Narc think of Keats. Yeah, that's right, the poet Keats. Because don't make the mistake, because Narc speaks in this kind of broken cadence and broken English, because he's a caveman, that he's not intelligent. He's really, really smart. And he starts reciting a Keats poem that talks about kind of the effect of man on Earth and their connection to nature and how nature is eternal, man not so much. So yeah, Narc's a pretty intelligent guy. Next page, we see that really famous scene from DC Rebirth with Wally and Barry embracing, with Barry saying, "How could I ever forget you?" And the pain on Wally's face, like, yeah, I'm back. That's great. And Barry says, you know, yeah, this is it. This is a return of hope. Like, and a lot of people felt that way. It was a very powerful moment in DC Rebirth where Wally came back, and it was everything we were missing since the New 52 reboot. And, but for Wally, it kind of sucked, right? And he even says, Barry, where's my family? Like, he comes back and it makes everybody else happy. But, you know, when Barry left, or when Wally left, rather, he had a wife, he had kids, he was all about his family. And now he comes back into a different multiverse, or, you know, the main, you could consider it the main multiverse, the prime, whatever name you want to give it. But it's not the same, right? It's not the same as it was pre-Flashpoint. And Barry's touchstones, Barry's reason for existing, you know, his wife and his kids. I mean, Linda Park is still there. And if you've read the Teen Titans, or I guess it's just Titans, then you know he, you know, tried to have a connection with her, but the kids are gone. And this is something that has led Wally here, right? It's the whole reason he's at Sanctuary, is because he's been back for a few years and it hasn't gotten better, right? That loss of his family is still bothering him, rather than, you know, time heals all wounds, so they say, but it's actually getting worse for him. And then on the next page, we see Harley and Ivy. Now, Ivy's been taken to Sanctuary, if you guys remember, after the events that happened in the Batman comic. Harley's not even supposed to be there. It's Ivy who's supposed to be there to try to reconcile these two aspects of herself. It's been a few years where we've seen Ivy, when she's with Harley, and she's kind of the more human type form, where she has, you know, normal colored skin, and she's a little more she's kind of right in line with Harley. I won't go so far as to say she's heroic, but she's not actively trying to hurt anybody. And then there's the Ivy that we saw in the Batman comic, the one that took over the entire world, where she has the green tinted skin, where she's much more this kind of avatar of nature, right? She's sort of this aspect of the environment that's out to kill humans if they're going to destroy the natural world. And she's trying to reconcile that. But Harley loves her. So she shows up and she's like, I'm bored. And Ivy's like, why is it my problem that you're bored? You're not even supposed to be here, right? And Harley's like, yeah, I know. And then the scene shifts back to Narc, and he's talking about how sometimes he thinks about the world he came from before there was a society, there's no security, and things were simpler then, right? You lived by strength. Everything was war. You didn't have time for industry to build, you know, industrial civilization. You didn't have time for culture. There was no time to invent things or think about the way the natural world worked, or to know time or art or philosophy, right? And everything was violence. You feared death. And he said, yeah, the life of Narc then was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, short. So is that, I think what he's saying here was that better? Is that how it should have been? On the next page, we get Wally, and this is supposedly his first time meeting some heroes, some very iconic heroes that obviously know him well after, you know, he came back. We've got him hugging Superman. We've got him hugging Nightwing, him hugging Donna Troy, him hugging Arsenal. And from the words that are being spoken, Superman, you know, very, very happy that Wally's back. Nightwing saying, do you know what this means? Donna Troy's like, this is what we've been missing. You know, again, like putting that weight on Wally, putting sort of the weight of the world, almost the weight of the multiverse on Wally, saying, you're what everyone's been missing all these years. And Arsenal goes so far as to say, your hope. Not that Wally's return has brought hope back, but Wally himself is like the embodiment for hope. But you, in all these situations where Wally is hugging these people, we see these other heroes from behind, and we know they're happy based on the things they're saying and the punctuation, exclamation points, all that kind of stuff. But the expression on Wally's face is one of despair, I'll say. It's clear he's sad. Like, these guys are talking about how great it is that he's back, but his family's still gone. So for him, like, this isn't a happy time, despite how happy everybody else is. Then the scene shifts to another one of the holodeck rooms, if you will. And remember, Ivy is supposed to be here to try to reconcile these two disparate parts of her personality that can't seem to coexist. But instead, and I don't know if this shows her love of Harley or just the fact that Harley's kind of soaks up all the oxygen in the room and she doesn't really have a choice. But what the two have decided to do is to try to work on Harley's issues with the Joker. And so the Joker's there and Harley gets to kind of knock him out. And Ivy's saying, see, you know, you punched him. Doesn't that make you feel better? And we look at the expression on Harley's face, and it's clear that it doesn't make her feel better. Right? Like, there's no sort of, I mean, there's that whole philosophy of kind of face your fears, you know, get back up on the horse. And I think that's what Ivy's trying to do here, but it's clear by the expression on Harley's face that her just facing the Joker and facing him and trying to overcome him with violence isn't doing anything but sort of dredging up that sort of abusive past and dredging up some of those abusive memories. Then the scene shifts back to Narc, and he's talking about how before society, Narc was free in a way. He was free of a lot of responsibilities because he was so focused and had to be based on the world that he lived in and kind of the violence of it and the sort of prehistoric nature where your every waking hour was just trying to find enough food and stuff to exist. You know, it was a very brutal time. And he's like, I didn't even know that I didn't know any different. That was just my existence. Right. I knew I needed to eat. So I would eat, I would kill to eat. And I was happy. I was fulfilled because I didn't know any better. I had balance with nature. I was part of nature and like nature, my life was good, you know, cause I didn't know any better. So it seems like what Narc is trying to sort of reconcile is, does he even want to be around in this more modern world, being that it's so different and so much more complicated than the world he came from. And then we see Wally fighting with the Titans, and he's saying they were so excited. Everyone, there's a whole universe and everybody was reborn, but how can you be reborn without what matters to you, right? How are you supposed to be Hope without Linda, Jay, and Iris? And again, we see the rest of the Titans, they're happy to wade into battle. They're happy to be alive. And Wally is sort of left behind, right? It's this rebirth universe that happened in DC Rebirth where it made everybody else happy. It made the fans happy. But once again, Wally West kind of got the shaft. And then we see Ivy and Harley talking on the next page, and they're, you know, Harley's trying to explain how facing the Joker this way isn't really helping. But it's clear that they're devoted to each other. And as the scene shifts back to Narc, he's talking about the big question for him, the philosophical question is the old way better or the new way, right? Because in the old days, like I said, things were simple. If you wanted to eat, you fought. And if you won, you get to eat. And if you lost, you wouldn't get to eat. You know, it was that brutal. And in the old days, death was always there. It was a constant companion. It was a constant threat. And in the new way, you don't have to worry about death. It's not a constant companion. Instead, life is, right? Everything is so complicated. Instead of worrying about dying, you have to worry about living. And I love that idea. You know, here's Tom King using this, you know, caveman, very obscure caveman character from DC to really introduce an idea that's really profound. Like in the old days where your every waking moment was consumed with how do you survive? The worry is death. Like if I don't, you know, find enough to eat, if I can't protect myself, if I'm attacked, if, you know, whatever, can't find water, I'll die. That's the constant worry. What are the things I need to do today to keep myself alive? Now that Narc's in the modern world and the constant threat of imminent death is not there, now you've got to worry about what am I going to do with my life? You know, there's all these other complications that go on because you're not consumed with the immediate needs of just staying alive. It brings in all the other worries and complications of life. And I just think that's a really profound way to look at it because that goes way beyond, okay, you've got worries because you're a superhero. We've all got worries every day, you know, paying your bills, staying healthy, making friends, having a social life. If you're single, maybe you're out there trying to meet your match and have a family and take care of your kids and provide for them and provide for, you know, take care of your parents. And, you know, there's just all these worries that come with living now. And it's so fundamentally different from what a prehistoric caveman would have to worry about and just staying alive. So again, we see Wally and he's still stuck in the kind of that same mode. He's leaving one of the holodeck chambers and he's like, the Titans were all good. Everybody was good. Everybody was happy. Everybody was celebrating. Everybody was glad that I was back. It was hope returned. Everybody was just, the way he puts it, everybody was whole. They were made whole by the fact that Wally West had returned. But what was Wally without his wife, without his kids? you know, Linda didn't even know they'd been married. Nobody remembered the kids. Everybody else was just like they were supposed to be. They all became themselves again. They were all smiles. And Wally just felt alone, you know, because nobody even remembered that his kids even existed. And so the scene shifts again. We're back to a holodeck with Ivy and Joker. And once again, Ivy's trying to make Harley feel better by killing these fake Jokers. But I don't know. I don't think that's the right way to go about it. I think, again, it's just dredging up the abuse, basically. Then we see Narc, and he's saying that he's basically trying to think about this, and by basically turning his problem into an intellectual puzzle, he's like avoiding the problem. It's dead man arguing, right? And he names off some philosophers that, you know, may choose one side of the argument or the other. He says, Narc is not dead, but Narc misses the old days. And he misses animals and fighting and blood on the tongue. And he misses the grass and the sky. But that's neither good nor bad. Because living in those old days, Narc couldn't read Keats. And remember, he loves Keats. He recited the poem from memory early on. So it's not good or bad. It's just gone. And so without him really resolving this intellectual puzzle that he's set before himself, he's certainly a man out of time, and he's it's a conundrum, right? Like, well, life was better back then because I was happy and I was fulfilled, but only because he didn't know any different. And now that he's in the modern world, there are things that he, you know, clearly loves, being able to study philosophy and art and poetry and things like that. And it seems like he really enjoys those things, but it comes with all that extra complication. So he says, Sanctuary, Narc is done. And he leaves the room. Narc's ready to go home, but you can tell by the expression on his face, even though he's ready to leave Sanctuary, it almost seems like he's leaving because he knows there is no answer. There is no way to really reconcile, you know, the fundamental paradox or kind of, it's not necessarily a paradox, but this puzzle, there's no right answer. You know, it just depends on your perspective. And he's smart enough to see it from both sides and know there is no real answer. But as he leaves the holodeck, we get the alert from Sanctuary saying, emergency, emergency, proceed to nearest exit. While he's in a holodeck, he hears the same thing. And so are Ivy and Harley, but Ivy tells Harley, wait here, you're not supposed to go here. I'll go. It's probably just a drill. I'll go make sure there's no real trouble. You stay here and I'll be back in a couple minutes. And then next the scene shifts and we see Narc outside with another of the heroes, and they're both covered in blood. And Narc is saying, you know, I'm scared, but you know, you shouldn't be scared. And Plato said that life was a cave. It's like being in a cave, watching shadows on the wall. And the goal of life is to leave the caves and see what the shadows are. Like, you can't just stay sheltered and locked up was Plato's point. You got to go out and experience. And Narc's like, I actually, you know, lived life in a cave looking at shadows on the wall. And I left the cave and I saw the world. But I think Plato might have been wrong. The goal is not to leave the cave. The goal is to know the cave and the world, and that there are shadows everywhere. But maybe Narc thinks it, and he lays back down and clearly passes away. So interesting take from the caveman. He couldn't make up his mind one way or the other when he was in Sanctuary, and he was kind of resigned to leaving with that question still there. And now it seems like he's taken a third tack. The most important thing, it doesn't matter if you lived your life as he did in the past, where all his waking hours, his whole existence was focused on surviving, or being in the, you know, present time where life's much more complicated. The most important thing is to know yourself, no matter where you, that's where true fulfillment kind of comes from. So again, real profound kind of idea here that Tom King is giving us with a caveman, this obscure DC character. Meanwhile, we see Arsenal has been killed as well. And Wally is holding him saying, Roy, why, you know, the kids I didn't want, and you don't really understand what's happening here. He says, I didn't want to be alone. And then all of a sudden he's blasted by Booster Gold because Booster thinks he saw him kill everybody basically. And Harley has just come in and she sees Booster do this. And he says, I didn't know you were there. And she said, well, I'm not supposed to be here. And Booster's like, okay, where are you supposed to be? And she says, I don't know, somewhere fun. And then we get the last page, which is another confessional by Clayman. And we get 9 different characters, and they've all been asked the same question as the first 3 characters we saw on the first page. How many have you saved, basically? And they give various answers. Commander Steele saying, doesn't matter how many I've saved. It only matters to prepare for the next one. Blue Jay talking about coming from a different world. Should he count, you know, those? Solstice just apparently keeps track. 437. She just gives a straight up answer. And then Kid Devil, Hotspot, Nemesis, Arsenal, Gunfire, they all give various answers. But I feel like these last 9 characters are here giving different answers to that same question, and all very different answers, basically to show us that it doesn't matter. And in that way, I think what Arsenal says out of anybody is the one that's the most close to the truth of the matter. And he says, none of this, not 1 ounce, is about counting the people you save. It's about doing what you can. It's about getting off the couch, right? Just get off the damn couch. That's what it, to me, what matters the most if you're a hero, that you tried, not how many people you actually were able to save, but just, you know, trying to get involved. So it's probably the most profound issue of Heroes in Crisis. Probably the one that my guess is, and I just remember people disliking the series as they were coming out and people saying it, you know, wasn't very good. Just that was my overall feeling, that I think a lot of people didn't get it. And I sort of stopped paying attention to the reviews and kind of the consensus of people on social media and such, because I got tired of it, of people being negative and not sort of seeing it for what it was. But I do have a feeling, looking back on it now, I have a feeling that this was probably the issue that was the most poorly received. I could see a lot of people not getting what Tom King was going for in this particular issue. So anyway, so Jay, did you read Heroes in Crisis when it came out?
Actually, I was deployed when it came out. So I got pretty much the whole set at one time. For me, it kind of made more sense to me because, you know, being in the military and being downrange for so many years, you see a lot of guys that have PSD. So it kind of hit home for me. And, you know, you sit there and talk to a person, say, I got these problems, yada, yada. But you don't want to let nobody know because people think you might be out of your rocker, or the real world might think there's something wrong with you. Oh, why this guy seeing a shrink? Is it something he's going to snap on me? So I thought it was kind of cool. It was Sanctuary, and they didn't want the secret to be out because they didn't want people to think here was, you know, will have issues. So it kind of hit home for me a little bit on that one. And then Narc, I remember him because he's actually in the first run of the Teen Titans. That's who found him. It was issue 32. He was frozen. That's how they found him.
Gotcha. So did you, I mean, you said you read it all at once, like in trade or?
No, when I was deployed, see, when I was deployed for 12 months, I get a shipment of comics. So they waited like every couple of months and they sent me a whole run. So I would have something to read.
Gotcha. So you read it all in big chunks then.
Right. And the only thing I was missing was the last one. When I got back, I got the last copy.
So right from the start, having that perspective of, you know, being in the military and knowing guys that deal with PTSD, you thought this was this is good that somebody's finally putting this out there. Somebody's finally talking about it in a comic. And I think that was the whole point for Tom, why he wanted to do it.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. These guys see probably more death, you know, in their world. So it's like, does it affect them at all? Really? I mean, I know they're heroes, but they are human. They're not Superman.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I know a lot of people know this about Tom, but he was in the CIA and he was in country for a long time, almost a year, right after 9/11. You know, working on dealing with insurgents and such in, I think he was in Iraq or it might've been Afghanistan. Anyway, it was one of the two, but yeah, I mean, this is something that he saw just like Jay, that he saw firsthand. So, I think it was important. And, you know, we had Tom on the show not too long ago, a special Christmas episode. And we talked about Heroes in Crisis. And I talked to him about I didn't want to come right out and say people hated it. But I gave him a chance to talk about it in terms of, you know, looking back on it now and the way it was received, would you go back and change anything? And he said, no, he's actually very proud of it still. You know, whether it was critically acclaimed like other work he's done or not, wasn't the point. The point was, hey, these are issues that we need to talk about. And, you know, in this particular issue, you've got three characters that are focused on Wally West, Narc, and Harley, who all are dealing with some level of trauma, and it's all different. You know, Harley's dealing with the after effects of an abusive relationship, both mentally and physically. Wally's dealing with loss, and Narc is dealing with sort of an identity crisis of sorts. Like, you know, who am I in terms of, if I'm living in the caveman past or I'm in the modern world, where do I belong? A crisis of identity, you could almost say.
But I got that too. Because yeah. Narc, like for me, Narc, it reminds me of people that I know that love to be downrange. That's their life. And when they come back to the real world, they don't know how to cope. They're like, oh, there's a grocery store. I can have all the ice cream I want, you know, anything I want. But it's like, I'm not happy here. I'd rather be back over there. That's what I got from Narc. And then Wally, I seen guys that, you know, come back from deployment, their wives leave them, and everybody's like, oh, we're so happy you're back. You know, you're back in the real world. They're like, yeah, but you can tell in their face, they just don't want to be there. They feel empty. You know, they're not whole. And for Harley, you know, she's like, you know, she's a shrink too. So she's just, you know, like, well, what have you done? When she asked the computer, you know, like, how many have you saved? She's like, well, how many have you saved? I don't think you're doing your job. So she's trying to, you know, play reverse psychology, but she knows she's got a lot more issues because, you know, she was abused.
Yeah, the thing about Harley, she still has those walls up, you know, like when you're in an abusive relationship, you build walls and you keep people at a distance and you don't open up because you will learn while you're in that relationship that any kind of vulnerability is going to be taken advantage of, right? Like if you share any part of yourself, your thoughts or whatever, then the abuser turns it, you know, they use it against you later on. So of course, Harley's not going to answer questions or, you know, give any information about herself. She's going to be closed off because of those walls. So, I mean, Tom King is not trying to give us any answers here, right? At least in this particular issue, he's just saying, look, here are three different people who, and forget about them being heroes. Here are three different people who are dealing with three different kinds of trauma and how it affects them, right? These are, you know, forget about them being heroes. Like I said, these are like legitimate problems that real people deal with. These are the kinds of things, loss, you know, abusive relationships or, you know, identity issues, whether it's because you can't come out as homosexual or bisexual or trans with, you know, gender problems or whatever it is that you're hiding who you truly are, that creates trauma. And it can cause a problem. So I really think this is sort of a transitional issue of Tom just saying, you know, forget about the fact that they're heroes. Think of them as people. Here's the kind of things that people deal with. So again, I kind of wish that Jay had read it, you know, issue by issue, because I'm curious if he would have felt like I do that. Yeah, when this one came out, that people just really didn't get it. But I wasn't curious enough about it I didn't want to go back. Let me go back and read the initial reviews for Heroes in Crisis 6, because I didn't want to dive back into that. Just the vitriol that people had that people don't like it. But anyway, that's enough about Heroes in Crisis number 6. Let's move on to Justice League number 19. Let me give the creative team really quickly here. So it's written by Scott Snyder. We have art by Jorge Jimenez. Who also gets credited with co-plot for this. Alejandro Sanchez does the colors, and Tom Napolitano handles the letters. And this is sort of weird, right? So we saw where the Justice League had a chance to sort of heal that break that was in the source wall in Justice League Annual 1, and they were unable to do it. The Legion of Doom showed up at the last second and kind of foiled their plans, because they're hell-bent on, Lex Luthor anyways, hell-bent on freeing Perpetua. She thinks that Perpetua is a way to ultimate power for him, and they were able to stop that from happening. This is the first issue we see that starts to deal with the consequences of that, because in issue 17 of Justice League, we see that was the issue where Martian Manor reached out to Lex, and we learn about that sort of hidden history of Lex as a child and Martian Manhunter as a child being kidnapped, and they actually had a connection when they were kids, and it's Martian Manhunter trying to reach out and appeal to Lex to sort of switch sides. Lex has already got the ball rolling with the Totality and Perpetua, and there's no way to stop that, but they'll have a much better chance of succeeding if they can get Lex to come over to their side. And then issue 18 of Justice League was actually a Legion of Doom issue where we see Lex and Brainiac sort of have a little bit of a power struggle on who is going to sort of lead the Legion of Doom and sort of be able to be in charge. So 19, this issue is the first one where we finally see the Justice League going, okay, we know that we were almost successful in sealing the wall, the source wall, but we failed at the last moment, and now things are more dire than ever. I mean, they were so close, and then it just kind of fell off a cliff. So that's where issue 19 sort of picks up. And there is an alternate cover by Rob Liefeld, and Jay and I were talking about it before the recording started, and my God, it's just bad. It's just so bad. Wonder Woman has this like feathered Farrah Fawcett hair that just looks bad, and her face is no different than Superman's, except his eyes are a little more squinty, and Batman is kind of, for lack of a better word, it looks like he's grimacing, like he's taking a dump, like he's a little constipated. He hasn't been eating enough greens, and yeah, it's bad.
It's like it's rushed.
Yeah, I mean, his art all looks like that these days. I mean, I remember reading his recent Snake Eyes Dead game. And don't get me wrong, Rob's a great guy, loves comics, loves a lot of the same things we do. But I think the problem with Liefeld is that he's been around for so long now that there's a certain nostalgia to his art. But if he would have kept drawing all this time, I think he'd be in a much better place. I think his art would have evolved, right? Because that's the thing. Like, once he sort of hit it big, and, you know, I was as big of a Liefeld, I'm probably not the biggest Liefeld fan of anybody back in the day, but I enjoyed it back in the 90s. It was full of bombast and over the top and what have you. And I was buying X-Force and all that. And then he, you know, went over to Image and formed Image with those guys. And we know how late he was on stuff constantly. And he got a little full of himself to the point that the other Image guys kicked him out. You know, they fired him basically. And he stopped putting out work. You know, he didn't need to work. He made so much money that he kind of, you know, rested on his laurels. And I just think it's a missed opportunity, because I think he does have talent. And I think if he'd been drawing consistently for the last 20 years, that his art would look very different. And you could say, well, you could say the same thing about Jim Lee to some extent, but at least Jim Lee was, he was at least doing covers here or there. And then, you know, even came back to do Batman Hush, and he's done various things over the years. And I do feel the same way. I think Lee's art would be, I mean, it's crazy to say Lee's art could be even better, but I do think it could be even better than it is. I mean, he's still a great artist, but he could maybe be talked about as one of the greatest ever. But obviously he has a lot of other things that he likes to do. You know, he's a very intelligent guy, and he loves the challenges on the business side of things and all that. Plus technically, you know, from just a technical perspective on anatomy and perspective, and you know, technically Lee was always a better artist anyway. So he maybe didn't need to grow as much as Liefeld did. So anyway, that's enough about Rob Liefeld. This wasn't all what we need to be talking about for this episode, but it just, man, I look at this cover and, oh, it's just bad. It's just bad. So anyway, getting back to the story itself, basically what happens here is the Justice League gets together, and they have a prison, basically this little, I don't even know what to call it. Like it's this little ball that, or cage that's made of black diamond that's capable of holding even a Calypso. And what they do is they trick Mr. Mixius Pidalic into coming to Metropolis, but the 90 days hasn't passed yet. So for those not familiar, Mixius Pidalic, he's this imp from the fifth dimension. He's one of the most powerful beings that Superman has ever fought because he basically, the fifth dimension is made of imagination. So anything that Mixius Pidalic can think about, he can make reality. And the only way to get him to go back is to get him to say his name backwards. And the reason that that's the case is because he basically created the rule when he first showed up because he thought it would be fun to play with Superman. The whole 90-day things has to do with what I thought was he wasn't able to return for 90 days no matter what because it had something to do with the energy between dimensions. But obviously, I'm either wrong about that or misremembering, or they changed it. Or Scott Snyder might have just changed it to make it work for this story. But the fact that he does come back in the 90 days hasn't happened yet. Basically, it hasn't that time hasn't elapsed. He's powerless. He doesn't have his powers like he normally would have. And so once he discovers that, he's like, well, why'd you guys bring me back? Like, what's going on? Why did you trap me here? And they basically say, well, we need your help. Because the universe is in big trouble. You know, we're up against this all-powerfully, incredibly dangerous evil. And he's like, okay, I get it. I know what you're up against because we're facing it too. You're talking about the baddest mischief of all, which is Perpetua. So he actually schools the Justice League and sort of explains it to him. Because Superman's saying, we need to help each other. And, you know, we need information and we need to find out how we can fix the source wall, how we can sort of, you know, clean up this mess that we made. And Martian Manhunter says, yeah, we recently learned that on Hawkgirl's wings, there's this pattern that could be the key to fixing the multiverse. We think it's a map to something in the fifth dimension. And Kendra's saying, yeah, I mean, if we knew where it went and what's there, then we could be prepared. And Mixius Pidalic's like, okay, let me explain this to you. The stupid first dimension is just a stupid point, right? Just a dot. The second one is a line. Boring. Third, well, that's the material world, like it's stuff, right? The fourth is time. And then the fifth, where I come from, that's imagination, where anything you can think of can be, but it's dying as well because of everything that's happened ever since you tiny brains broke the source wall, is how he puts it. So there is another dimension, and the fifth dimension is not where your map is pointing. Your map's actually pointing to the sixth dimension. And they're like, wait, there is no sixth dimension. I said, oh, but there is. And it's the key here. Let me explain it to you, right? Like, here's the multiverse where you guys all exist and where the four dimensions are. And then we add the fifth dimension, which is still part of that, but it's invisible because it's, you know, imagination and you can't necessarily see it. But it's sort of the energy of those first four dimensions. But above that, above those four dimensions or five dimensions rather, is the control room of the multiverse, if you will, and that's the sixth dimension. And he only knows of four beings who could ever exist there, and it's the monitors. So the monitor, the anti-monitor, the world forger, and then their mother, Perpetua, the one that started it all and who was supposed to allow herself to die once the multiverse started, but hang on because she's evil and narcissistic and greedy and all that. So he says the only place that things could maybe be set right, that you could fix the damage you've done, is there in that sixth dimension. And Martian Manhunter says, well, could you create a portal list to the sixth dimension so we could go there? And Mixius Pidalic's like, normally I wouldn't be able to, but because you broke the source wall, you may have, you know, created a path where I maybe possibly could do it. But Wonder Woman's worried. She says, well, if it's beyond our comprehension, could we even survive there? And Mixia's Piddalick's like, ha, that's a good question. I think that the only one who could survive there would be Superman. Any of the rest of you would be driven mad. And Superman's like, well, why me? And Mixia's Piddalick's like, well, over the years, I've infused you with fifth dimensional energy, and it could possibly protect you for this moment, because I exist out of time and I'm one of the two most powerful imps. The other watches over Batman, and that would of course be Batmite. And even though we test you with pranks and what have you, we're really your imaginary friends and your guardian angels. And you know, we exist outside of time. And so Starman wants to know, well, if you exist outside of time, why don't you just tell us, does this plan work? And Mixia's Piddalick says, well, you got to remember the sixth dimension, it's outside of time too, and it's beyond my perception. It's above us all, so I have no idea. And Superman, you know, being Superman, he's if there's a chance, he's going to take it. And so he tells Mixia's Piddalick, yeah, go ahead, open the portal. And Batman sort of expresses his misgivings about this, but Superman's like, look, we're running out of time. This is bigger than any of us, and yeah, it's scary, but we got to reach higher. And I've got to do this. And so Superman asks if anybody else is opposed to it. And they say, well, I mean, this is our only choice basically. And so Mixia's Piddalick, with a little bit of effort, manages to summon a doorway, and Superman walks through, and the rest of them are sort of left standing there thinking, well, I wonder how long this is going to take. And Batman says, well, if we're dealing with a realm outside of time, who knows how long it could take? It could be months or years or decades. And before he can even finish saying decades, the door opens back up and Superman walks back through, but much, much older. His hair's gone gray. He's got a beard and a mustache, and he's wearing this white and gold costume. And he says, I'm sorry I was gone for so long, but it's good to be back together, guys. And they're all happy to see him. And Batman's like asking Martian Manhunter, are you sure that's him? I said, yeah, according to my powers, it looks like him. And he says that he's been gone for a decade, but he looks a lot older than just 10 years older. And he basically says he went to the sixth dimension. He followed billions of threads of possibility. And the good news is, out of those billions of threads, he found a single road through the problem that they have, the situation they're currently in, that allowed them to save the universe. So he's like, come with me. I'll show you. I've prepared something. I'm like, wait, I thought we couldn't go with you. You know, and this universe still needs protecting. And so Starman says, I'll stay behind because I still have memories that Jaro needs to retrieve. And Mira says she's going to stay behind as well because Atlantis needs her. And Superman says, yeah, okay, I set the energy portal to handle everybody's signatures, so you guys will be able to exist and not be driven mad in the sixth dimension. And so they all head through the door. And when they appear on the other side, Batman says, what just happened? And we see this new sort of future version of the Justice League with the older Superman there. We see a White Lantern, John Stewart. We see what looks to be almost a Batman Beyond hybrid. It's like a Batman, but he's wearing a trench coat almost like, and he's got a red bat symbol on him. We see Wonder Woman, old and gray. We see three different versions of the Flash, and we see a Martian Manhunter and Hawkwoman flying, holding hands, and they have a child who looks to be a mix between the two. And to answer Batman's question, Superman says, it's simple, Bruce, we won. Come inside and let me tell you the story of how we saved everything. But all is not as it seems, because on the last couple pages, we see the real Superman, and he's been transported somewhere, and he's in total darkness. And as he's walking along trying to figure out where he is, he stumbles and rolls down a hill, and he ends up in a giant pile of bones. And when he looks out, using his X-ray vision, his telescopic vision, to try to find anything, there's no light, there's no sun, there's nothing for him to draw radiation from to gain power. And he's trapped. And it's clear that somebody was prepared for this. Is it Mixius Pitalic that tricked him? Is it somebody else? But the Justice League's most powerful member has been taken off the table. So now they're going to have to solve the problem without the help of Superman. And they think, according to this fake Superman, that it has been solved. So pretty interesting take. This is really a transitional issue between what I feel is the first big chapter. I feel like the first probably, I mean, I guess you could say 18 issues if you want to take the 17 and 18 issue that I was talking about that happened after the annual, you can. But really, the first 1 through 16 of Justice League and that annual is really the first act, if you will, of Scott Snyder's big totality story that ties into Metal and Death Metal and now Infinite Frontier, because that is about the Justice League, you know, having broke the source wall in Metal and then starting with Justice League number one, that whole journey of trying to fix it, being so close to fixing it, that story that takes place in the annual, being so close to being able to fix it and then having it fall apart on them and knowing that it didn't work, basically. And now really with this issue, it's almost like issue 17 and 18 were a bit of an interlude, because this is where the story really gets rolling again of, okay, fixing the problem at the source wall, to try to keep our multiverse separate from whatever is on the other side, didn't work. So now that Perpetua is her resurrection is closer and her rise to power is closer, her return to power, I guess you could say, the threat is getting bigger and they can't stop searching for a solution to that. And this issue really starts the second act, where they start to look for alternate means of solving their problem. So it's a big epic story from Scott Snyder. I know there's a lot of people that are kind of confused by it, and it is kind of confusing because it's not structured the best in terms of understanding everything, because there's so many big ideas and maybe they're not all fleshed out or explained as well as they could be. And the other part of it being, if you're not a huge DC fan and you're not reading a big chunk of books where everything gets explained, then it can be sort of confusing. So for me, I remember reading this when it came out and seeing that future Superman and going, whoa, that's kind of cool. And then finding out in the last couple pages that it wasn't even him and being real intrigued. So like it or not, you know, whether you like the story or not, it is a compelling read. And I think this was a pretty good issue. So were you reading Justice League as it was coming out in big chunks, Jay? Was that a title that you were checking out?
Well, actually, the most of the mainstream from DC. I think I collected about 50 titles from DC. So it was easy for me to follow the story because I already knew what was going on. I like the story a lot too, because like the last couple of panels where they show Superman, that's, you know, he finds those bones. If you look closely, there are other Supermans. That's why he's like, well, no, he's like, I can't end like this, because he realizes that he's not the first one there.
Yeah, it's happened over and over and over, which is interesting. We've been reading a lot of Matrix-y like titles.
Yeah. But I do like the imps, because even in Batman's world or Superman's world, they always cause trouble, and it's always funny, I think.
Yeah, what do you are you a big fan of Jorge Jimenez's art? I feel like, I mean, I like his art a lot in certain things, and I got used to him on Justice League, but I'm still not sure that he's the best artist. But here's one thing about him: is he's fast.
Yeah, he's not, and he's punctual. He's always on time, unlike some people. But yeah, the books come out on time. But there's also a bunch of, like, you read the book, I forgot, because when I saw it again, I was like, I remember reading this story. But I also remember there's a bunch of little jokes in there that they make to each other. Like, where Batman is like, the imp says, hey, you know, Gotham's not as fun. Metropolis is way more fun than Gotham. And I hear Batman going, that's not true. You know, Gotham's way more fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that is one aspect of Snyder's run. And I mean, do you like the humor?
Well, it's kind of different because it's Batman doing it. That's why it kind of made it like, okay, well, Batman really say underneath his breath? Because I guess that's what it's showing. It's like saying under his breath. So it's like, okay, that's kind of funny.
Yeah, and I'm never one to say, well, comics need to take themselves too seriously. The only problem I have with when Snyder throws in jokes like that, because he does it throughout his entire Justice League run, it goes back to me thinking that the whole story, I mean, ever since Metal started, I feel like the entire, I mean, from Metal to Leviathan Rising to Year of the Villain to Dark Knight's Death Metal, all of that, while I understand the story, a lot of what happens in the story, you have to sort of fill in the blanks. I don't want to say it's choppy, but again, I go back to the thing of Scott Snyder being this guy who can come up with these incredible ideas, but sometimes the ideas are so big, you don't have enough space in the books to really tell all the story that you need to tell. And I feel like even when you give Scott extra pages, instead of just saying, okay, let me flesh out the ideas that I already have, instead he thinks of new ideas to put things in there. So, and I don't know that it necessarily used to be that way. I think, and I don't know if it's just because he got so popular. I don't know what it is. But when you read a lot of his work, it sort of requires the more of the reader. You've got to sort of fill in the blanks yourself. Whereas when you read something like the recent event comic, Generation Shattered, that's written by Andy Schmidt and Dan Jurgens and Robert Venditti, that tells you everything you need to know. There's no work on your part to be done to try to fill in the blanks and understand what's going on. It's laid out for you. So they're so fundamentally different. And I think one style works a lot better in big events and one doesn't. And again, I like Scott Snyder. I like his work, but I think that I can see why some people feel like it's a failure, that it doesn't explain enough. It requires, because I mean, you read Death Metal and you know, it's everything but the kitchen sink thrown in there. And so right. Spoon fed to you. It requires you to do some work. And I know it doesn't necessarily work for people, but I think it is valid. I mean, I've seen other writers do it, and I know there's a segment of comic critics who just think that that's not how it should be. So yeah, it's just different. The problem is that when you're getting these stories in small chunks, like if you're buying the monthly issues, it does make that harder. And then you end up having to go back, well, wait, what happened? And it can be confusing unless you have a real good handle on it and you're reading the books, you know, multiple times. I've read so much of Scott Snyder's Justice League run over and over to cover them for a podcast. I feel like I have a good handle on it. And I guess think of it this way, listeners, like if you have to go back and read a comic two or three times, if you're going back to it a month later, 2 months later, 6 months later, a year later, and reading it again, hey, there's more value for your comic dollar, right? Or you could always just listen to these episodes and we'll recap them for you. So,
yeah, I agree with you. When I read the Justice League, like I said, I was collecting it, but I had to go back and read number 10 to catch up and see, what did I miss here? There are some holes. I guess I assume that you will do it, I guess, or I don't know, is the writing style, like you said. But I guess after a while, you just kind of get used to it and you go, okay, I got it. Move on.
Yeah. Or you're at least going back and you're flipping through. And I do kind of wonder, I mean, you're like me, you've been reading comics long enough to remember before it was everybody wrote for the trade. Right.
So right.
I'm sure it's a different reading experience if you're reading for the trade, you know, right. And you go back, you flip through the previous trade. Okay. Yeah. I remember what happened. And then you read the new trade and you get a big chunk of story and it's real satisfying. I don't read my comics like that. I don't read most of the time. I don't read my comics in big chunks. There are some times where I do, where I fall off of a particular title. Like I am right now with Gideon Falls, which is just tragic. I have like 10 issues, the last 10 issues of that series to read. So that'll be a big chunk. But for the most part, I don't do that. So
you're very lucky. Cause like, when I came back from my last deployment, I had, I remember 340 books I had to read. So I pretty much took a month off of work and everything, just sat there and read every day.
Man,
I've got caught up.
I've got more than that. I mean, I say I read most of my stuff, but I mean, that the stuff that I read that, to talk about. But when you talk about other stuff that I need to read, see, this would have been good. It would have been good to have you on our, Manny and I did one of our 12 days of the Comic Source episodes. I don't know that Manny joined me on that one, but anyway, I did one about what runs do I want to read in the new year that I'm challenging myself to read. So, you know, kind of a way to keep myself accountable. Then next year I'll go back and I'll, you know, next Christmas or this coming Christmas, I guess, weird to say in January, but I'll go back and say, okay, did I get to those books or not?
Yeah.
Like I want to reread Amazing Spider-Man from number one all the way up, but that's like 850 issues. I want to kind of do the same with Hulk. I want to do the same with Captain America, with Iron Man. Like I want to reread all that stuff. X-Men to a lesser extent, because it's going to take a lot longer because
there's so much meat and potatoes in the X-Men. It's like, you got to have every single, you can't just have Uncanny and just X-Men and, yeah, new X-Men. You got to have all the titles because they always cross over. So without the one book missing, you're like, ah, what happened?
Yeah. So yeah, there's quite a few titles like that where I'm like, you know, I really this year want to do more reading, but then I still need to read like all the stuff that I need to do for like the podcast that I still need to read. And, you know, I've got a lot of episodes that I need to catch up on there. So yeah, I mean, there's never enough time. There's never time to read all the stuff that you want to read. And yet I'll find myself going back and reading things that I already have read, you know, like, because I just have to. There's certain books that I have to go back and read every, like at least once a year, you know, like.
I got your favorites and whatnot.
Yeah. Like Irredeemable. I got to go back and read that. Clone is another one I'll go back and reread periodically. And sometimes what happens is I'm just doing research on something and then I'll, you know, I'll look up a particular issue or this or that. And then before I know it, I'm like sucked in and then I'm reading, you know, a particular run of Teen Titans or Vigilante or Iron Man. I think that happened to me with Iron Man last year, where I was going back and looking, because I was getting ready to interview Christopher Cantwell, who's the current writer on Iron Man, and I wanted to go back and look at some of the books that he was talking about that influenced him,
right,
and his run. And before I knew it, I was like, ah, yeah, I was like sucked in and I was reading a bunch of Iron Man. It was like 3 a.m. and here I am, you know, reading a bunch of classic Iron Man stuff. Like, so yeah, I think, what else was I saying? Oh, like I haven't read all the House of X, Powers of X, Dawn of X stuff. So I want to read that. Yeah.
They're pretty good.
I want to finish my Thanos chronology. I haven't read from start to finish. I haven't read all the Geoff Johns Green Lantern. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff to read in 2021. We'll see if I can get there. But anyway, yeah, we may have to put you on the spot at some point, on one of these episodes and see, and maybe we'll do it with you and Manny since he didn't join me on that one. And we'll see if we can get you guys to, on record of what big runs or epic runs you want to read in 2021, and then, you know, do a follow up in a year and see if we made it there. So, all right, well, let's move on to the next book that we're going to talk about. It's Shazam number 3, part 3 of the 7 Champions. It's written by Geoff Johns, art is by Dale Eaglesham and Marco Santucci, and colors are by Mike Atea, and letters are by Rob Lee. So this is just continuing sort of the version of the Shazam family that Geoff Johns created for the new 52. It was a backup story in the Justice League title that he was writing. And basically Billy Batson becomes Shazam, becomes Captain Marvel like normal. But unlike normal, and as it happened back in the Golden Age originally, he is able to share that power with some of his foster brothers and sisters. And so all of a sudden the Shazam family, rather than growing slowly over time because that's the way they did things back in the golden age. Well, if Captain Marvel is popular, let's create a Captain Marvel Jr. Oh, well, if Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. are popular, then let's create a female version of the character and call her Miss Marvel. And, you know, eventually you had all these members of the Marvel family. Johns just creates them out of whole cloth in that story that ran in the back of Justice League. So eventually they get their own title. I think it ran for 13 or 16 issues, something around there. And unfortunately, it took almost, I think, close to 3 years for those issues to come out, 2.5 anyway, because it was constantly late. It was just a really late book. And I know that Jeff Johns wanted to do this title with Gary Frank handling the art. Gary Frank's the one that did all the art for the backup Shazam stories in Justice League, but Gary Frank was working on the Doomsday Clock with Jeff Johns at the time, so they got Dale Eaglesham to do it instead. But unfortunately, kind of like Gary Frank, Dale Eaglesham's art is really detailed, which is actually fortunate because his art's spectacular. Now the downside to that is it makes him slow, and that's why this book was delayed so many times. And Marco Santucci came on and he filled in quite a bit on quite a few of the issues and helped to keep it on track a little bit. But yeah, just this title, it sold relatively well considering, but I've talked a lot in the past on the podcast about what a disservice a book does to itself or the creators do to a book when they have it come in late all the time. People forget about it. The racks are crowded. There's so many comics coming out these days. If you don't have a book that comes out on a regular basis, people will forget about it, or they'll drop it because, you know, like we're just talking about, it's hard enough to remember what happened in the book last month. Now when you're talking about it being gone for 3 months, you know, they're just like, yeah, I don't even remember what was going on. I'm not going to bother to pick it up. So anyway, what's been going on in the first couple issues is that Shazam family has headed to the Rock of Eternity, which they basically get through by using their magical powers to walk through a little tunnel in their closet. And their latest foray to explore the Rock of Eternity turned up a train station or a subway station, and they found a map to all the magical lands that the Rock of Eternity connects to. And so they decide to go. You know, they are kids. This isn't exactly a good decision. Especially because their foster parents think that they're upstairs doing their homework and they're just gone because they've left and they're gone for hours. And do you not think your foster parents are going to come up and check on you? Like, think about it. Right. But anyway, they take the train and they end up in this place called the Funlands, which is just like, an amusement park on steroids is how they describe it. There's kids running everywhere, and there's candy and there's rides and balloons and just this amazing fantasy world, like just the best of you know what any kid could wish for. Everything's free, all the candy you can eat, pizza, soda, toys, and it's all ruled over by somebody who's calls himself King Kid. And so when the Shazam family shows up there, and they're all in their civilian identities, and King Kid introduces himself and he says, Billy Batson and his wonderful Shazam or his wonderful family, you're going to be my guests. And, you know, let me introduce myself. And he gives us kind of his origin. He's King Kid. The Council of Wizards made him the ruler of a Funland. And it's his mission to give any kid like him who comes from a troubled home or any of the six other realms a place where they can come and leave their worries behind. That's what Funland's all about. They have 306 amusement rides, 22 candy factories, 55 malt shops, the biggest picture book library in all the seven realms. And the Shazam family is kind of in heaven here. Everybody but Mary, you know, she's the older one. She's almost 18, a little more responsible, but the rest of them are pigging out on pizza and drinking soda and eating hot fudge sundaes, eating donuts with pink frosting and marshmallows. And they're just having a blast. But Mary, there's something about King Kid that rubs Mary the wrong way. And she wants to know how King Kid knew who they were before they met. And he said, well, for more years than he can remember them, the magic lands have been sealed off from one another No kid could find their way to the fun. No new kid could find their way to the fun lands. And all of a sudden the tunnels opened back up and kids started finding their way to the fun lands again. And he looked in his magic pudding, which apparently is some sort of crystal ball, to see who turned the power back on. And he saw the six of them on the train. And he thinks this is a sign that a new champion has finally been chosen by the wizard, right? Because there's supposed to be six. There are six chairs in the Rock of Eternity, or seven chairs rather, in the Rock of Eternity. And there's only six of the Shazam family now. And King Kid basically says, I'm your seventh champion. Like, share your magic word with me, which is the word Shazam, so I can join you. And one of the Shazam family, she's ready to just blurt it out. She says, the magic word is, and before she can say it, Mary puts her hand over her mouth like, hey, we don't need a seventh family member. We don't know this guy. Like, we can't just go blurting it out. And King Kid's like, Mary, what do you, you know, I understand that you, you know, are worried, but ever since the seven members of the Council of Eternity were killed by the Sins, the magic lands need a champion, right? There should be seven champions, one for each land. And who better than me to be the champion of the land that I already rule over? And so the Shazam family's kind of discussing amongst themselves, and Billy's like, well, you know, the magic word, it doesn't let me share my power with somebody, even if you know it, unless I know you in my heart. Like, I know you really well. And so King Kid's like, well, then you can let me in your heart. And he says, please, you know, I've been waiting for a chance to be a champion for so long. That'll help me bring even more kids into Funland. And some of the other members of the Shazam family are like, why can't we tell them? And we can tell that Mary just keeps, you know, she just doesn't trust this guy. And King Kid says, Mary, how can I earn your trust? And she's like, look, no disrespect, but we're new to all this. We don't know that much about the seven lands or you or anything about them. And King Kid says, well, let me tell you when I started at the beginning. And he says, his parents were cruel people, and it shows him locked in a closet. And one day he got in trouble for spilling the porridge. And he was worried he was going to get in even more trouble. So he ran away, and his parents came running after him, and he tripped and fell down a well. And when he woke up, he was in this peppermint field, and he found a scepter, which is his wishing stick. And he sort of walked around for a while and eventually got bored, and he was wishing for something fun to do. And while he was holding his wishing stick and thinking about that, this merry-go-round appeared. And he was fine for hours, maybe days. He was riding it and he was happy. And eventually he grew lonely. But then children started to arrive hour after hour, more and more children. And pretty soon his merry-go-round was overflowing. So he created another one, and so on and so forth. And eventually that all became the fun lands as they know it now. And he says they're the greatest of the magic lands, you know, and the safest. And he shows them a map, and they're asking questions. What's the Wazander lands? And, you know, King Kid says, I've never been there. I've never been to any of the other lands except for the Earthlands, which is, you know, where he came from. But he's like, but I know the other lands could use your help. A lot of them were nearly destroyed by Mr. Mind and his monsters when they invaded, you know, out of the monster lands. And that's why the monster lands is still closed off. And so it seems like King Kid is somebody they can trust. And Billy's thinking about, there's all this stuff they don't know about the magic lands and this world that the wizard never told them. And so King Kid's like, look, we're supposed to work together, you know, with our shared power. Nobody could defeat us. We can bring fun to all the lands. And Eugene is saying, well, you know, maybe that's why we were given these powers. And Mary says, maybe so, but you know, we can discuss this at home. We need to go. And King Kid's like, home? Why would you ever want to go home? And Billy's like, well, you know, our parents are probably worried about us. And that King Kid's like, wait, what? You live with your parents, like, on purpose? Mary's like, yeah, foster parents are probably, you know, worried sick. We need to go. And they even mentioned that Mary's probably worried about her college exams. And King Kid's like, wait, she's an adult? Well, technically she's not yet, because she hasn't turned 18, but soon. And King Kid's like, oh, okay. Well, if Mary says you should go, and he starts leading them out of the room, but he looks around at all his little clown minion type servants and says, "Get her, my clowns." And they grab Mary and they grab everybody actually and throw them down these tubes in the floor. Now, Eugene and Pedro and Billy are able to say the magic word and transform into their Shazam family alter egos. And when they do, King Kid's like, "Liars, you're all adults. It's a trick. The Funlands have been invaded," and they start attacking them. So there's a big fight, and eventually Captain Marvel, Billy, is overcome. The rest of the members of the family all end up in various lands. So Pedro and Eugene end up in Game Land, and it looks pretty futuristic. They don't know exactly what, you know, where they are or what's going to happen. Darla and Freddy end up in the Wildlands, where everybody is basically these anthropomorphic animals. And they arrive there and they're unconscious, and we see some police officers come upon them, and looks like one's a dog or a bear of some kind, another's a cat. And they say, "Well, the mayor's not going to like this. Look, they're humans. What are we going to do with them?" And they say, "We follow the law, Jones. We feed them to the tigers." So that doesn't bode well. And then we get the blurb for next month in Shazam: Into the Wildlands, Into the Game Lands, and the Secret of King Kid. So everybody has been sort of scattered except for Billy, who's still in the clutches of the Funlands and King Kid. And what happens next, we're not going to find out. Now, at the end of the first issue, Billy's biological father did show up and say he wanted to see Billy. We didn't get any of that subplot in this issue. And then in issue two, we got a little bit of Dr. Savannah, as well as Mr. Mind, who are apparently working together, probably the two most well-known and biggest threats to Shazam and the Shazam family, their nemesis, as it were. But again, we didn't get any of that either, which is really strange because the regular cover by Dale Eaglesham shows Mr. Mind, but we don't even get any Mr. Mind. No subplots in this one. It's just all Shazam family and the Funland. So the art by Dale Eaglesham is absolutely spectacular. A lot of detail in it, but for the majority of the issue, it's actually Marco Santucci. So, and I'm a big fan of Marco Santucci as well, but he doesn't put anywhere near the detail in. But his facial expressions and his character work is spectacular. So, you know, either way, I don't think you can go wrong with either one. I think they're both really talented. And, you know, again, this is a book that I wish had come out on time, because it would have meant we would have had a lot more of it. Because I do like this take on the Shazam family. And I think if you are a fan of the... God, what's his name? The guy that played Shazam in the Zachary Levi. Yeah. If you're a fan of the Zachary Levi movie, it really has the same sort of feel that this Shazam series has. So if you've never checked it out, I highly recommend picking it up. Pick up the individual issues, pick up the trade. At least you'll be able to read it all in a timely fashion, because there's not going to be any delays because it's over. So. Anyway, what are your thoughts on the Shazam series and this issue in particular, Jay?
Well, I was one of those people that collected it because of the first cover. I was like, "Oh, this is some good artwork." So I bought it, and I was a pull customer, but every time I said, "Hey, is it out?" "No." "What?" So I eventually dropped it. So, and I kind of regret it, I guess, now looking back, because I forgot how good the story actually was. And the artwork is phenomenal. I mean, there's little things you got to catch, you know, in there. Like, one's got Darla waving to like one of the clowns you see waving back to her as he's trying to discuss about the map of the world. So there's still little things like that in there you'll catch, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the art and you can totally understand why Dale Eaglesham is so slow. Like, if you look on the title page, I mean, there's got to be like 30 or 40 kids on that page, you know?
Well, like I said, just incredible detail, and you can actually see what they're doing, which is cool. You know, what's going on, and, you know, their facial expressions, but it's like, it may take forever. Like I said, I was just one of the ones I did collect it, but like I said, they just weren't on time. So I just kind of dropped it. And same with the Image, a lot of their older books back in the day when they were never on time, they always got dropped because I was like, I'm done with it. I just got tired of it. The only thing they were consistent on, I think, was Spawn. That was pretty much it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree with you 100%. And that's why I say, like, so this is out now in its entirety, and go and pick it up. It's only, I think there are three trades, but really it's only two stories. Like, they tell the story of the Magic Lands. And then there's another story that I won't even hint at. I won't call it anything, 'cause I don't want to give it away. It does have to do with Billy's dad a little bit, and him showing up, but there's basically just two stories. And yeah, when two story arcs, and when you say, wow, this series came out for over 2 years, you'd expect at least three or four stories, and we only got two, and it's too bad. So
I think they only went 15 issues. That was it. I think it stopped at 15.
Yeah, it was either 15 or 16, right? Somewhere right around there. So all right. Well, I think that's gonna do it for this episode. As always, we want to thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.